From our early days in Sunday school, many of us are quite familiar with the story of Joshua and the Battle of Jericho. But there are very important lessons tucked within this story that you may have missed. Stay tuned for The Balanced Word.
Wake up my soul. Wake up early in the day. Wake up my hand and the instrument I play. Wake up my voice. Let the world hear me say, you are worshipped and exalted here today.
We're looking at some of the many stories contained in the Bible right now in The Balanced Word. Pastor Dave Rolfe is about to look at one of the more familiar ones today, in Joshua. God is about to give Joshua and his people marching orders that must have seemed like a strange strategy. They followed God's plan, though, and victory was obtained. It came because they listened to God and obeyed orders. But right on the heels of this victory came a disappointing defeat. We'll see why near the end of our time together. Find your place in Joshua, and we'll get started.
Well, now turn in your Bibles to the book of Joshua, the 6th chapter. Joshua chapter 6. We're going through the whole Old Testament and hitting on various key Bible stories as we're going through the Bible. Next year we'll do the New Testament, but this year we're in the Old Testament. Now, so far what's happened as we've progressed, you know, through the first 5 books of the Old Testament is that the children of Israel were in captivity in Egypt. Moses led them out. They crossed the Red Sea, came out into the wilderness, received the law, spent 40 years in the wilderness, and finally, Joshua is leading them to go into the land that God had promised them, the land that their forefathers had lived in, and now they were going to finally go and receive their inheritance. So it was an exciting time. They had been waiting, you know, over 450 years for this. So the journey began by them crossing the Jordan River, and God parted it miraculously for them, even as he had the Red Sea 40 years before. So they came into the land, and at this point, they are facing their first battle. Now, when we're talking about this, I think I have to detour just a little bit. If you've always been going to church and you hear all the Bible stories and everything, you probably don't even bat an eyelash when we talk about going into the land, killing everyone, and taking their land. But if you're just like a normal person, you hear that and go, that just kind of sounds weird. Like, why did they have to do that? Why do you have to go kill everyone? Is it right to violate their borders? And that's a difficult thing to explain from our perspective, where we are today culturally. But let me give you a shot at something that might at least help you. If you think about the historical and cultural context, it might make a little more sense to you. We live in a world where borders are set collectively by the world, basically. Every country that exists because the other countries agree those are your borders and that's your country. Now, every once in a while, someone will cross one of those borders, intrude into someone's territory, and try to take it. And we say, that's imperialistic, that's really wrong, the world stands up against you. Unless you're Russia taking part of the Ukraine, then we're like, oh, that's okay. But even at that, we're going, this doesn't seem right. Somebody needs to do something. And so we take a bold stand with some economic sanctions against a guy who's a multi-billionaire. And we think that's going to hurt him. And he's laughing at us. Okay? But see, we all grew up in a world whereby borders are sort of protected, not by might, but borders are protected by international pressure and sanctions. What you have to understand is, throughout history, it wasn't that way. Throughout history, your border was protected by you. And if you were going to expand your country, or if you even wanted to have a country, you went in and you killed people, and then you protected the borders. That's just the way it was. If one country thought they could defeat another country, they would do it. And they would wipe them out, and now that became a part of their country. Now, you might go, oh, that's so barbaric. So how many of you are Native Americans? I mean, we have our country. Guess what? We got it by killing Indians, Frenchmen, Brits. We killed anyone that got in the way of us having a country. And that wasn't something that was controversial. at the time, because historically, that's just what a country does. If you can't defend your borders, you don't deserve to have a country. And so that's just the way it was. So for them to come in, and this had been their land, and God had promised it to them, they weren't going to just move in and have everyone go, oh, you're Jews? Okay, here, have it. People were going to have to die in order for them to get it, and there's just no way around that. I am totally in sentiment with people who are pacifists. I think being a pacifist is a beautiful thing if everyone was a pacifist. But pacifists get killed by non-pacifists. It's just the way it works. Now, the other thing, though, you go, but why couldn't they just beat them in a war? Why did they have to kill everybody? Why did they have to kill women and children and cattle and all this kind of stuff? Well, a part of that comes because, again, culturally, we do not have the kind of collectivist, nationalistic passion that was typical of nations back then, and some nations even today. As Americans, we're all about independence. So, for instance, if you check my DNA, I suppose, I haven't even been interested enough to check it, but I think I have relatives that came from England. But I don't care what happens to England. I don't care what happens in the rugby championships or soccer with Manchester United or whatever, because, like, who cares? I'm not there anymore, and I don't really care if I have British blood. I'm not, you know, I'd be ashamed of that. No, I'm just, but I just don't care, because we're individualistic. But in a collectivist culture, they believe, they're so strong on genealogies and connectedness in a family, that if something happens to one member of their race, that happens to all of us. It's why we don't understand why, you know, some people will blow themselves up for a cause. To us, somebody blowing themselves up or crashing an airplane that they are in just looks like a really stupid thing to do. But in a collectivist culture, you're all a part of one mass of people. And it's why Japanese pilots flew their airplanes and crashed them into our carriers. It's for the people. It's not about individualism. So when we look at those times and go, why'd you have to kill everyone? Now, first of all, everyone didn't have to be killed, because some people converted. In our story, Rahab, who was in Jericho, ended up converting and ended up in actually the messianic line of Christ. But what would happen is, if somebody knew that they were a particular race and nation of people, if you left them alive, they would come back after you. Think about it, even Moses. He's raised his whole life for 40 years as an Egyptian in every way possible. But the first time he sees an Egyptian beating a Jew, he killed the Egyptian, because his loyalty was to his bloodline. And that's the way they would see it. Now, you know, later on we find there were times when, like, for instance, King Saul was commanded to wipe out the Amalekites. He didn't do it. He killed almost all of them, but he spared a few. And not only later did David have to do battle against the Amalekites, guess who killed Saul? An Amalekite. It's like, come on, there's just a few of them. What damage are they going to do? But we have to understand, in a collectivist culture, it's kind of like when I was a kid, and I hope this doesn't offend you if you're Samoan, but we would always say, you don't get in a fight with a Samoan. Because for one thing, they were really tough, and they really were. But also, if you win, now you've got his brother and his other brother and his other brother and his cousins, and there's like no end to that. That's kind of the way it was with their culture. If you're going to fight them, you have to take them all. You know, it sounds horrible from our frame of mind, but in their cultural situation, it made perfectly good sense. That's the way it was all over the world. And I don't know if that makes you completely satisfied. I don't know that it makes me completely satisfied, but at least it helps me to understand it a little better when I'm understanding it in the context in which it happened historically. So for our story today, we have, in the first few chapters of Joshua, they crossed over the Jordan River, and now they're looking at the first significant barrier in their path, and it's a city called Jericho. And Jericho was a strong, well-built fortress, basically. And It actually would have been a great place to use as a center of operations, because from Jericho, you're up there on a hill elevated a little bit. You could look out from the top of the city and see the whole Mediterranean coast. You could see Jerusalem and Judea to the south. You could see the whole lush Jordan River Valley and the Galilee up to the north. But they weren't going to stay there. They might have been tempted to stay there, but God had other plans for them. But they had to take it. Now, let me explain too. Don't think of a city in those days as what we would call a city. Because you would think, you know, LA or, you know, even, I mean, the smallest city that you can think of is bigger than Jericho was. Jericho, from the excavations, we know that inside the walls, it was about 6 acres. If you include the walls, because they were wide and people lived in them, no more than 9 acres, probably 1,200 people lived there. So imagine a fort the size of our property here, plus the Baptist Church's property. That's Jericho. It's this little tough fortress built with 2 walls, an inner and an outer wall of bricks put together with backfill in between, a retaining wall, backfill, and an inner wall. But still, how are you going to get into a place like that? Well, they sent 2 spies in and said, go check this place out. They went in there. The rumor got around that there were 2 Jewish spies because they knew what was happening. All of a sudden, these Jews are coming and everyone's wondering what's going on with them. So they ended up at the house of Rahab, who was a prostitute. Now, if I was Joshua, the first thing I would have asked these 2 spies was, wait, what were you doing there in Rahab's house? But he apparently let that go. But she protected them and made it possible for them to survive and get back to Israel and go, okay, let's go. So in the end of Joshua chapter 5, Joshua knows we are going for our first battle. And so he was probably had a hard time sleeping. He got up and took a walk. And there's a huge guy who has this big sword drawn that he runs into, who ends up being God. It's probably an appearance of Jesus Christ in the Old Testament. He calls himself the commander of the armies of God. But Joshua comes up to him and says, are you on our side or are you on their side? And he says, no, I'm the commander of God's armies. And so he's like, I'm not on your side, I'm not on their side. You better worry about being on my side. And so then he says, and by the way, you're on holy ground. Take your shoes off. Remember, that's what the Lord had said to Moses when he was speaking to him from the burning bush. Now he says it as he appears as a soldier. And so he begins to lay out in chapter 6 the instructions for their first battle. And it's one of the strangest battle strategies ever. He tells them, go to the city of Jericho and bring the Ark of the Covenant, this fancy box that they had made, with the Levites carrying it, a few soldiers around it, and some trumpet players, and march around the city of Jericho on day one and then come home. Really? Yeah. Okay, well, that's easy. And then the second day, do the same. The third day, do the same. The sixth day, you're doing the same. Every day, you're doing the same thing. On the seventh day, you're going to do the same thing, but you're going to march around it 7 times. And at the end of that, when I tell you to, blow on the trumpets really loud. And then tell everyone, when you hear the trumpets, start just screaming, erupt in a big cheer. So Joshua's like, okay. So they did it. And maybe they figured, I mean, this sounds pretty crazy, but what happens after you've walked around it the 7th time on the 7th day and you yell and blow horns and nothing happens, you're like, okay, let's get out of here. And, you know, nobody's really going to kill you for something like that. But they went ahead and did it. And when it happened, the place caved in, just like God said it would. The walls tumbled down. But God had told them something else. He said, basically, I'm going to win this one for you. But when I do, this place belongs to me. It will be the first sacrifice that you make in the land that I'm going to give you. You're going to sacrifice this city. So there's some gold and silver bowls and stuff that I want you to grab, because those are going to end up going for temple worship. But everything else, burn it down. Burn everything. Now, kind of a strange thing to do, because this city could have been a valuable base for them. Nope. This is an offering that you're going to give to me, God said, by doing this. And the only way you can really give something to God, you can't toss it up in the air and tell him to catch. When they would do sacrifices, they would burn things, and then the smoke would go up, and it was a symbolic way of saying, this is yours, God, we are presenting it to you, receive this. And so the first battle would be won by God, and the first city would be given back to him to acknowledge that he was the one who did it all. So it basically went really well. It's interestingly, with the archaeological digs in Jericho over the last 100 years or so, they found not only, in fact, evidence that these stone walls had fallen over, they actually found one section that may have been the house of Rahab, where God had spared it, because there's one section of the wall that's still intact, and it's on the side of the wall whereby if you were going to head back to the Judean wilderness, that's where you would want to leave and go to. So just kind of an interesting side note. But as far as everyone was concerned, this was an amazing victory. And after they burned it all down and they did what God told them to do, it must have been exhilarating. And Joshua is just going, man, this is easy. This is cool. I like this. I've been waiting 40 years for this kind of an opportunity. Yeah. And now they're ready to do their part, because they had done the sacrifice to God. God won that one. Now they couldn't wait to get out there and go kick some serious Canaanites. And so the next place is Ai, and it's a little podunk souvenir stand compared to Jericho, which isn't very big. It would be like, conquer all this land and now go take the bus stop over here. It's like, so they talked, and you can read it through chapter 6 and 7. And in chapter 6, they said, hey, we got this. They sent spies in. They came back. They said, we don't need to send our whole army. We don't need to send the Ark of the Covenant or anything. We'll just send a couple thousand guys, 2,000-3,000 guys, and we'll wipe this place out easy. So nobody complained about it, so they went for it. And they went, and this little podunk town defeated them, chased them away, and killed 36 Jewish soldiers in the process of them escaping. And that was shocking. But it was also really scary. Because it's like, yeah, we beat Jericho, but that was just by walking and yelling and blowing horns. This is our first battle, and we just get demolished, and people died, and that's because we're doing it. Now, a lot of people make much of the fact that it doesn't say that they prayed and asked God how to do it. It doesn't, they just kind of did it on their own. They didn't have the confidence, they had too much confidence, only took 3,000 people. They should have taken the whole army. But none of that is the reason why they failed at Ai. God makes it very clear the reason they failed at Ai. But when they failed in chapter 7, Joshua has an interesting response. Look at Joshua chapter 7. Well, we'll start with verse 4. After saying that, yeah, we just need a few people, it said, so about 3,000 men went up there from the people, but they fled before the men of Ai, and the men of Ai struck down about 36 men, for they chased them from before the gate as far as Shebarim and struck them down on the descent. Therefore, the hearts of the people melted and became like water. They went from being so exhilarated by seeing this great victory at Jericho that now they were absolutely just like they melted. Oh, this is horrible. They had been like that before in the wilderness plenty of times, and Moses was always there to call them to courage and repentance. But Joshua, this is a little disappointing. In verse 6, it says, then Joshua tore his clothes, fell to the earth on his face before the ark of the Lord until evening, he and the elders of Israel, and they put dust on their heads. And Joshua said, alas, Lord God, why have you brought this people over the Jordan at all? to deliver us into the hand of the Amorites, to destroy us? Oh, that we had been content and dwelt on the other side of the Jordan. Oh, Lord, what shall I say when Israel turns its back before its enemies? For the Canaanites and all the inhabitants of the land will hear it, surround us, and cut off our name from the earth. Then what will you do for your great name? A lot different than Moses. Joshua lays on his face, and he's like, God, why did you get us into this? What is wrong with you? You know, your name is going to be sullied now, and you deserve it, because we're going to be destroyed because we had this defeat. I mean, he's just completely, desperately crying out, not even asking for God's help at this point. He's just telling God, we're done. We quit. And it was your fault for bringing us here. How could he have flipped? They lost 36 people. You know, when they were in the wilderness, that many people were dying every day, more than that. So what's he so depressed about? It was just days before when you know, they conquered Jericho, you know, with him leading mightily. And now he just feels like quitting from some little minor skirmish. And again, they only sent 3,000 people, so they could still go back with their full army and probably wipe out Ai. But he's just completely depressed. Maybe you've been there sometime. Some little tiny thing goes wrong and you just feel like it's the end of the world. Well, that was Joshua. He's 80. He's laying there on his face, just feeling like it's all over.
You're listening to The Balanced Word. In addition to being our teacher on the program, Dave Rolf is the pastor of Pacific Hills Calvary Chapel in Aliso Viejo. We're going through the Bible right now in a series called Bible Stories. We have these messages archived for you at thebalancedword.com or call and request today's message on CD at 949-362-7475. And as a special appreciation gift for your donation of $10 or more, The Balanced Word is pleased to send you all of these messages in this Bible Story series on a USB thumb drive. You'll hear some of the Bible's greatest stories from Genesis through Revelation. To make a secure donation, go to thebalancedword.com or call 949-362-7475. And don't forget to ask for the Bible Story series as you give. Again, we're at thebalancedword.com. And we'd like to take this time to invite you to Pacific Hills Calvary Chapel. Our Sunday morning service times are at 8, 9:45, and 11:30. Again, we're at ccpacifichills.org if you'd like more information. Or if you're outside of the area, you can watch our live stream right there at ccpacifichills.org. Check out Pastor Dave's one-minute messages, a great way to start the day. You can listen to them at thebalancedword.com or watch them on Instagram or Facebook by following CC Pacific Hills. Here's Pastor Dave with the rest of his message on Joshua and Ai.
In verse 10 of Joshua chapter 7, so the Lord said to Joshua, get up. Why do you lie thus on your face? God's like, come on, quit being a baby. Get up. You're making a fool of yourself. Get up. I think sometimes when we're laying on our face, God's just like looking, going, would you just get up? You are so dramatic. So now God says, you didn't ask me what the problem was. Here's the deal. There was somebody who didn't do what I told you to do with Jericho. Somebody kept back some of the things that were committed to me, that were supposed to be set apart for a sacrifice to me, and they grabbed it for themselves. And Josh was like, well, we better find that person. And so they had representatives from each tribe of Israel come up, and somehow God would show them, nope, it's not them, nope, not them. Yep, that's the guy. That's the family. So then they would bring the families from within the tribes, narrowed it down, and it finally came down to a guy named Achan. And they go, Achan, what did you do? He goes, oh, well, I mean, I got a couple scarves, some silver and gold coins. It's really nothing. It's in the floor of my tent. You want to take them? And they said, well, God said that whoever does this must be stoned and then burned because the sacrifice of Jericho is not complete. And now you have put yourself in a position of being a part of that sacrifice, you and your family and all your stuff. Kind of severe. But remember, they're just getting started. And if God doesn't communicate clearly that when I say to do something, you need to do it. And when you do what I tell you to do, you need to do it completely. And if you don't, people are going to get hurt.
Discovering balanced living through the Word of God, this has been The Balanced Word with Dave Roth. We'll have another great Bible story for you next time. This program is brought to you by Pacific Hills Calvary Chapel in Aliso Viejo. Online at thebalancedword.com.
Wake up my soul. Wake up early in the day. Wake up my hands and the instrument I play. Wake up my voice.